Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your high school reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me today is Jason Snell, returning.
I'm back. May the Ford be with you, or something.
Jason, he tends to be my go-to guy for all these kinds of literary sci-fi novels, and that's because, of course, Jason is the fearless leader of the Incomparable Network, and I wanted to thank him publicly for bringing Sophomore Lit onto that network. This is the first time he's been on Sophomore Lit since I made that that join.
Well, thanks. It's fun to have you on the network, and I swear I did offer to read Red Badge of Courage. I just want to put that out there, but I know not everybody is willing to read these weird sci-fi novels that you get assigned in high school, and I did, you know, all the ones we've covered, I did get assigned and read in high school, so I'm not even making it up.
Well, this time we are doing Aldous Huxley's famous dystopian novel, Brave New World, which I wasn't assigned in high school, but I did read at the tender age of 12. And that's because,
that's because
there was a made-for-TV miniseries in 1980 of Brave New World that ran on NBC. Younger listeners to the podcast won't know this, but back in the 70s, starting with probably with Roots, there was a huge fashion on network TV for these miniseries. And they did an adaptation of Brave New World. They did an adaptation of The Martian Chronicles, I remember, as well.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one, yeah.
You can see the entire NBC adaptation of Brave New World on YouTube. I recommend watching maybe about 5 minutes of it because it is bonkers crazy the way that late 70s, early 80s TV is bonkers crazy. It's not a lot like the novel, but it's there. And after I saw it, I thought, oh, I got to read this book. And I tried several times. I tried when I was 12, and I never quite made it through when it actually starts to get to story. There's a lot of exposition in this novel. And when it actually starts to get to the story, I started to bail out as a kid. I did reread it a few years later. But the experience of rereading it now, I had exactly that same feeling, which is Huxley really is great with these long passages of exposition, and he kind of loses it when he actually talks about characters.
Yeah, are there characters? I guess there are characters.
Right. And how was it? Tell me about your experience having this in high school and rereading it now.
Yeah, so this was my senior year in high school. This was in my AP World Lit class. And again, I don't know whether this was assigned or whether I read it from a selection. I think some of these sci-fi books that I read because like you were given a list of 20 books and you got to pick one. I was like, well, I'm going to read the sci-fi on that. But I read 1984 in eighth grade because it was 1984. So, you know, I was probably a little too young for it, but it was the year, so why not? And then this was an interesting juxtaposition for all of us 4 years later. And I remember almost nothing about it. I remember one of the scenes very early on where they're taking, like right at the beginning, where they're taking the tour, where all of the kids are sort of in the institution, and they just sort of describe this futuristic, airy kind of institution space that they're in. And that's literally all I remember. Something vaguely about a savage in the future land, and that was it. And so when I reread it, I was interested to reread it because like I seriously remembered nothing, and I was pleasantly surprised actually by a lot of it. Not all of it, but a lot of it. I actually think I appreciated it way more as somebody in their mid-40s than I did as a 16-year-old or 17-year-old.
When I say that this book doesn't have characters, I believe that, but I also think that that's not the only way to write a book, is to write a book around characters. This is a book of ideas.
Yeah, and yeah.
That was a lot more in vogue at the time, which was, this book was published in 1931. So it's one of the first of the big dystopian novels. In some ways, it was a response to H.G. Wells. Today, we remember H.G. Wells primarily for his kinds of, like action-y or almost sci-fi horror stories like War of the Worlds or The Invisible Man or The Time Machine. But
right.
But he wrote a lot of books about futurism, and he had a lot of opinions about the ways in which technology and new advances in psychology and biology would order the human condition. And this, in some ways, was Huxley's response to all that, kind of that very optimistic view that the Victorians had.
It's definitely about ideas and trying to envision a future where it's hard to think about it now because it's 85 years later. But this is when they bring up Henry Ford, and you know, the idea here is that what if you industrialized humanity, right? What if you used the industrial lines of production and the assembly lines of Henry Ford and did all of your society, including how people are made and who they are, by those techniques. And I think it was much fresher in the mind of people in the 30s than it would be today, when we've been living with that for 100 years. But that's what the idea is here. And at some point, while we talk about this, I want to talk about his extrapolations, because from the vantage point of 85 years, you can actually see the parts that he got like surprisingly right,
right,
about what was going to happen to our society in the future. Whether he was trying to predict or just warn, it's always funny to see old science fiction and see how well they did. And I think Huxley, there are a few places in here where I had to stop myself and say, I just accepted what he said, but because I'm in 2016. But that was quite a shot in the dark in 1931.
Let's talk a little bit about this as science fiction, because it strikes me that Huxley is sort of like the other authors we've read, particularly like Kurt Vonnegut, in that he is a guy who sometimes doesn't easily get lumped in with sci-fi. He's obviously writing science fiction. To anyone who reads this book, you're like, oh, this is science fiction. But it gets put on the shelf with great works of 20th century literature, and it's not often pointed to by people within the genre as a formative work. I'm always interested in this because I always think that serious literature has a tendency to poo-poo genre fiction. And,
absolutely.
And then, like, some genre fiction comes along that is so central and important, you know, sort of like when Sherlock Holmes comes along, that it's kind of almost exists outside the world of mystery fiction because now it's world literature. And this kind of also transcends its origins to become... I mean, the Heritage Book Club, which was the book club my parents joined when I was a kid and had all the great works of Western literature, and these giant deluxe editions had an edition of Brave New World. So it was there. It got the stamp of approval as great lit. And
at this point, science fiction was you know, it was like the very earliest of the pulp fiction days of science fiction, and you know, Brave New World is about ideas, and although modern science fiction is as much about ideas as it is about technology, I think there was a lot more gee whiz science during the earliest days of science fiction as a genre. I think one of the reasons we remember the H.G. Wells that we remember is because that's the stuff that sort of became the root of the science fiction genre, and that's why that stuff is still remembered, and not so much the stuff about ideas. The fact that this is a novel of ideas and not about the mechanics of the science fictional world, I think perhaps made it go down a little bit easier in this period. And also, this was a period of a kind of cultural critique in the mid 20th century, post-World War I, Great Depression, rise of fascism in Europe. There's a lot of sort of culture of societal critique going on about what a modern world would look like. And so I think, you know, that all kind of wrapped around Brave New World and allowed it to kind of pass through the gates that maybe 20 years, 30 years later, there would be this much more clearly erected genre of science fiction where where you know, that you could get stuck in. But Huxley was like early enough, I think, and had enough of the ideas wrapped around what he was doing that he got a kind of move through. That said, from a modern reader's perspective, this is unabashedly science fiction. It's and surprisingly modern, I would say, as somebody who's read a lot of science fiction from, you know, across the 20th century and into the 21st. I was constantly impressed, toward the end a little less so, constantly impressed that this was something written in 1931, because it is a lot of science fiction books feel like this today.
Right. And the other thing I would point out is there's a famous essay that is circulated on the internet by Mark Rosenfelder called "If All Stories Were Written Like Science Fiction Stories," which dissects all the cliches about the ways in which particularly stories written in the 40s and 50s consisted of characters talking about the technology that they were using. And that is...
They still make books like that. I just read one of those last week and I rolled my eyes through the whole thing. They still do, but it's about how it works. And this this invented laser on this invented spaceship, let me tell you everything about exactly how they work,
right?
Even though they're made up.
Now, I won't go too much into Huxley's background, although he was a fascinating guy. And his life intersected with a lot of crazy people. You know, he came from a family of, on the one hand, educators. On the other hand, he had biologists in his family. And so he grew up in this kind of a charmed, educated, bohemian life that was both artistic and scientific. He rubbed elbows with the Bloomsbury Group, and he... spent a lot of time traveling in the States, where he was friends with fellow expatriate Alan Watts, who famously popularized Eastern philosophy, particularly Taoism and Zen, in the United States. And late in his life, Huxley turned to both Hinduism and Mahayana Buddhism. And I think that another reason Huxley is remembered today was he wrote this book called The Gates,
The Doors of Perception.
The Doors of Perception, right? About his experiences on mescaline, and that became a book that was just passed around the counterculture.
And that's the origin of the band The Doors.
Yeah,
that is the reference,
exactly.
Which is bizarre. Just
right.
Bizarre.
It's good to keep that in mind when you read this book, because that's sort of where he ended up late in life. So let's talk a little bit about this novel then. It, as I've said, it starts with a huge information dump. We are at the Central London Hatchery. We are told what's the years, like the years are now reckoned after Ford.
Yeah, so it's 632 after Ford. So it's like the 26th century, basically.
And a tour is being led of young technicians who presumably are going to eventually work at the hatchery. And so everything that's happening gets explained at length, and we get to see what this society is like from birth on. And we're told that in this society, no one gets born from parents anymore, that everyone is born as a test tube baby. Most people are produced from cloning a single egg and sperm, and we're told that you can have quite a few duplicates, except the higher the caste you're in, the fewer duplicates they want to make.
I'm fascinated by this too, just because you can see how the pace of human knowledge changes the concept. If this were written even, I guess, 30 years later, probably certainly 40 years later, they would all be genetically engineered,
right?
Clones. But the concept of DNA didn't exist. Obviously, genetics existed, and so he has this sort of they're sort of selective breeding. There's more of a eugenics feel, and then they artificially twin the fertilized eggs to make duplicates. Where now we would just, you know, just say, well, suffice it to say they're clones that
right.
are genetically engineered. So the mechanism is different because we understand science better, but it's just the trappings. In the end, he's talking about he wants us to see a society that is mass produced, where people are mass produced.
And where, from the beginning, the concept of family is abolished. You're supposed to see the idea of of traditional biological reproduction as being obscene and distasteful. And so once there's some time spent discussing bringing the embryos to term and how that there's, you know, a bit of discussion about the technology involved. And then we go into the other big issue here, which is in addition to the biological manipulation of the population, there is a mass social programming in the form of hypnopedia, which is subliminal suggestion. Basically, mm-hmm. from the beginning as a child, as a baby, you are conditioned to believe that you belong to the best caste. All societies is divided up into alpha, betas, gammas, deltas, and epsilons.
Right.
And you're conditioned to seek out your own caste, to think of your caste as the best, and to, because you're being groomed to fulfill a role in society, a role in the economics of the society, in the productions of the society, and you are being groomed to be happy about that.
Yeah, that's all throughout. That's the message, is that everybody's happy because I think the way they do it, again, since there was no genetic engineering here, they withhold oxygen from the embryos during a certain period while they're being developed, and that makes them less intelligent. And then they train them with this hypnopedia. They do this mind control kind of brainwashing. So the idea there is that those people are going to be the working class, but they're going to be happy. They're not going to aspire to anything higher. We're going to use society to reinforce the societal divisions. And again, they're engineering class difference, and they're doing it. In the end, it's to make everybody happy, and then. On the layer on top of that is that they also give everybody drugs. They give them soma, which is a drug that is sort of kind of keeps everybody happy and not worried about the world at large, unless they happen to be in the alpha class where it's their job to worry about bigger issues. I mean, it's literally the opiate of the people, right?
The thing that's interesting about soma to me is that he makes it clear over again and again that there's nothing. There are no bad effects of soma. This is kind of like a thought experiment of sort of like what would happen if you could actually create a drug that had no bad effects. I mean, the only bad effect is that it basically incapacitates you for the length of time that you're high on it. Additionally, we see the older children are being encouraged to engage in sexual play with each other, because the idea is that everyone needs to grow up having absolutely no shame about their body or about sexuality, because they, again, there's supposed to be a society of no attachment. And the only way that there will be no attachment is if everybody is sexually available to everyone else at sort of all times.
Right. And with, by doing that, painting this picture, I mean, he is painting a dystopian world where there's no family attachments, where there are no real relationships, that people are actually frowned upon of having a what we would consider a traditional monogamous relationship. One of the characters is told she needs to have more boyfriends because she's been dating one guy a little too much, and everybody's worried about that because you're not supposed to do that. This is one of those moments, and they all take drugs that make them feel good. They're all having sex with each other in groups or alone, but it's just like it's a promiscuous polyamorous society. And this was one of those moments where I thought there's been a lot of water under the bridge since 1931, and a lot of the things that I believe this upper class white Englishman from the early 20th century wants me to maybe be shocked by or repelled by. I think that's his intent, right? Oh, imagine this world. What a strange world it would be if all these social norms were changed. And from the perspective of 2016, I look at it and I'm like, yeah, you know, some of that stuff, we've kind of come, the society has evolved, and maybe we're becoming the Brave New World society gradually. I don't know. This section and the judgment that I think is implied that we're supposed to feel or rebel against, but that's an audience from the 1930s, I just think is really fascinating as an audience in 2016, because I don't read it the same way. And I think it's because in some ways our society has evolved to not make judgments about some of that stuff. Like, I know polyamorous people and judgment against premarital sex and judgment about using drugs. These things over the last 40 years have all kind of washed out of largely out of mainstream society. Certainly they're less of an issue. But so that was one of the kind of pleasures I took in reading this is, I think he wants me to judge this more negatively than I actually am.
Right. I think that this will become interesting, particularly when we examine the alternative presented in this book by the so-called savage John. But one of the things that I never quite figured out whether I enjoyed or whether it just bugged me about this book was Huxley's tone towards his characters. He's a very good writer. He writes elegantly and precisely and with great wit. But I do feel at all times like he wants me to, as you say, be shocked by the characters or at least have a laugh at their expense.
Yeah, and contemptuous. He is contemptuous towards his characters.
He's very contemptuous towards his characters. And I remember I took a, I was in a writing program, a fiction writing program, and one of the big lessons I took out of that was in one class, my professor said, you can't dislike your characters, because if you dislike your characters, your readers are going to hate you for it. You don't, don't beat up on your characters. Don't set them up to fail. Root for all your characters. And, this does not take that point of view. And part of me finds that refreshing because I don't read a lot of books like that anymore, but part of me is also a little bit like, really? You really don't want me to like this character, do you?
Yeah. I mean, the some of these central characters are really unlikable. Some of them are initially unlikable, like Bernard, who we meet. He's just kind of awful, and then we also meet Lenina, who is. She is not, I think, immediately as unlikable, but the decisions she makes are so terrible that I can't decide whether I dislike her or I just pity her or I just shake my head at the author for some of his attitudes toward women.
Yeah.
Some combination of that.
Well, Lenina is such a ditz, in so many ways.
Yeah, it's
and
true.
When I was preparing for this, I found a podcast of a program that ran on BBC Radio 4, a panel discussion of Brave New World. And there, all the panelists were making a big deal out of the fact that Huxley had just traveled to America shortly before writing this book, and particularly had gone to California and had seen a lot of actresses there. And they all seemed to think it was self-evident that Lenina was supposed to be like a ditzy California blonde. And I was thinking, first of all, that's very presumptuous of a bunch of Brits to be telling me this. But I don't know. The thing about Lenina is there are basically two female characters in this book, and neither of them is given much agency. Neither of them is particularly intelligent. Oh, by the way, the other thing to note about this world is there's a world government that they've organized completely. There are no more countries. Everything's been organized completely from the top down in this world government. But even though women are ostensibly equal participants in the workforce, everything about social interactions is still highly sexist. All the men are talk about women in terms of sort of the effect that the women have on them, and women are sort of seen again as the keepers of sexuality, because that's how, even in this world where sex is free, the discussion is always about whether or not the man will take her, and the women always want to be accepted by the men. And that certainly seems to be the driving force for Lenina, is that.
Yeah, she does have, I would say that I think the women have some sexual agency where they are allowed to pick partners. There are a couple moments I feel like where the women are talking in the locker room basically about what men they're going to have sex with, and so I could maybe give them that, but there's literally nothing else. And these are supposed to be the alphas. These women are in the alpha class. They are the peak of intelligence and genetics for women on this planet. And it's hard to see them as anything but obsessing about, like, boys and dates. And that's, I mean, I just rolled my eyes at that and said, well, this is, you know, this is a writer who is thinking about the future, but is still has, you know, his hangups, and the hangups of the early 1930s are on display with how the women are treated, that they're, the context that is most important for them is how they relate to men. And, you know, Lenina's story arc and Linda, who we meet later, it's all about, like, the men that they've been with. And in the case of the one particular man, John the Savage. And so, that was a little disappointing. And part of me thinks, you know, wouldn't it have been even more wild for Huxley to envision a world where the women and men are, you know, exactly the same in terms of their jobs and all of that. And they're like, oh, gender differences now only matter for sex and they don't matter for anything else. But he couldn't get there.
No, I'm going to say something here that I probably will regret, but I can't help but psychoanalyze Huxley here a bit, because later when we get to the character John, there is a lot of baggage he carries around about his own attraction to Lenina and his own dealings with women and his feelings about the sexual act. And I don't know that we're supposed to, we really should not take anything that any characters say as stand-ins for the author. But I do know that Huxley eventually wrote another novel called The Island. It was the last novel he wrote that was supposed to be about a sort of an actual utopia, what he thought would be the way out of, like, a Brave New World situation. And that also had some very screwed up sexual politics in it. And I just don't know. I mean, I don't know what Huxley's story was about his relationships. I don't know whether he was heterosexual or not. I don't know. But this book sort of drips with that kind of, like, the worst ways that men blame women for the ways that they feel about them.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and John definitely does that. Not to jump ahead too much, but it goes back to what I was saying about how we're supposed to feel. It's very hard to read the juxtaposition of this completely open sexual climate and the character of the Savage and his completely locked down, like, he's incredibly sexually attracted to Lenina, but refuses to act on it, essentially because he wants to settle down with a nice girl and be monogamous and have this be a meaningful relationship, and she refuses. It's impossible to look at that and not think the author really wants us to judge this as wrong. The author really wants to say, old-fashioned values as embodied by the Savage. Look, our society is the Savage now, and the New World has this whole other thing, and identify with him. And I had a hard time doing that because of everything you just said, which is like, I don't think the Savage is really viewing this as a healthy relationship either.
Right. Let's talk about the characters such as they are. We've mentioned Bernard, who works at the hatchery in some ill-defined role. And we're told he's like a psychologist or something. We don't know what he does, but it doesn't matter because it doesn't really matter what anyone does in this book. They just kind of exist to take us from one point to another and have discussions.
Conversations.
Right?
Yeah.
Lenina works at the hatchery as well. Lenina is sort of attracted to Bernard. She's been told by her girlfriends that she needs to stop sleeping with just this one guy, and so she's going to take Bernard up on an offer that Bernard makes to take Lenina on a holiday to New Mexico, where there is a reservation of savages.
Right. And we should say that Lenina and Bernard are they're oddballs, right? They are in a world full of conformity. They are not particularly nonconformist, but they are a little bit, right? There's something wrong about them. Bernard is short. He's kind of a rebel. He's got a pal who is a rebel that he talks to.
Helmholtz.
Helmholtz, who's got it. Helmholtz much smarter and has it together a lot more than Bernard. Bernard's like an amateur rebel, and Helmholtz is kind of a professional rebel. But I don't want to overstate it because it's only a little bit. Like Lenina's off because she kind of wants to date one guy and has to be cajoled into dating more guys. But still, they are. You get the sense that both of them are a little bit off the scale of dead on conformity. And that's interesting, and that's maybe the only interesting thing about them, but it is interesting that they're not quite right, which is what leads to the plot.
Yeah, there are some discussions between Bernard and Helmholtz about the world they live in. Helmholtz, by the way, writes the scripts for the Hypnopedia, and he desires to be a writer, but since there are no books to be had in this new world, or at least no great literature, he's not exactly sure how he would find self-expression anyway. Bernard and Lenina make some half-hearted attempts to connect. Everyone flies around, by the way, in this new society in helicopters.
Yeah.
For some reason, everyone has helicopters, which is, as far as sci-fi things go, that's okay. And there's a scene where Bernard takes Lenina over a channel of water and just like stares into the raging waves below and talks about how he loves being away from society, and Lenina can't understand this at all because
right.
That's the other thing about the society is although you can't have close relationships, you are never supposed to be alone. You're always supposed to be with people.
And that's what drives him to want to take her on this, non-luxurious vacation to the reservation in New Mexico that nobody from his region has been to since his boss went there,
right.
15, 20 years ago, whatever, 20 years ago, I guess, which is one of the coincidences in this story that is kind of ridiculous.
Right.
But what's interesting is that you get
the big boss is this guy named Mustafa Mond,
yeah,
who shows up. He's one of the world controllers. He's one of the a six or a dozen people in the whole world who kind of manipulate everything from behind the scenes, and why he's here at the hatchery is anyone's guess. But he shows up early on in the book just to address the group of technicians walking around.
Right. And he's there to explain everything later. Yeah, I guess it's the director is the one who is the immediate superior who last went there and says, oh, yeah, I went there with this girl just like you're planning on doing. But then we lost her and I guess she died and then I came back. And And it's strange. It's a strange moment plot wise. But, he's maybe a little of seeing himself in Bernard, but it's Bernard's drive to be different and to be alone and things like that. And Lenina is basically driven by her, societal, it's like peer pressure, basically societal pressure to, not just see the one boy that she likes. So she goes with him on this weird trek first time in 20 years to the Savage Reservation.
Right. And on the way out the door, the director also tells Bernard, oh, by the way, you better shape up and stop being such a mopey guy, or we're going to exile you to Iceland.
Yeah.
Have a good vacation. So they go off. When they get to the to this reservation, it's sort of based upon Zuni Native Americans, maybe Anasazi. It's not clear, and I don't think that I don't know that Huxley made a great attempt to ethnography here.
My guess is not. My guess is that he saw some movies with Indians in
right.
them.
He did. He did travel to the United States, and I think I read somewhere that he read someone else's account of having gone to a reservation, and that's what.
Ah.
So this is all percolating around in his head, but I don't think it's a particularly sensitive portrayal of anything, because what they see on the reservation is this kind of brutal fertility rite in which a boy is being whipped, and he's as long as he can stand being whipped by this shaman figure, that the more he bleeds, the more they will have a good crop that year, or something like that.
Mm.
It's not And then as Lenina is looking on in horror and Bernard is like, hey, yeah, man, that's great. This white savage shows up whose name is John, who speaks to them in English and says he wanted to be the one to get whipped. And he's so excited to meet someone from the outside world, because guess what? 16 years ago, his mom got lost from the outside world and she had him here on the reservation. And so it turns out that, yes,
he's the director's son. Yes, what a surprise. And that yes. The girl who was lost turns out to have just kind of wandered away and been found by the tribe people. And she's Linda, and she's there too, hanging out. She's not having a really great life because she's, you know, she doesn't have Soma anymore, and she doesn't have any of their biological things that they do to keep you eternally young. That's another thing that we should say that we didn't mention earlier, which is apparently the way that this works in this society is that you stay, your body basically stays like you're a 22-year-old until you're about 60, I think it is, 60 or 70, and then you just die.
Right.
But she's aged normally and hasn't been able to take any of the drugs, and she's gotten fat, and she's lived a life of a human being instead of these engineered lives, and that's they see that as sort of a horror too when they meet her.
Right. Linda tells Bernard and Lenina that, or maybe John tells the story. I don't remember who tells the story, but basically what happened was Linda, after getting divided from her group, finds out that she's pregnant. Her contraceptives haven't worked, and if she were in civilization, she could have gotten an abortion, but she can't here on the reservation, and she's too, it's too shameful for her to have even tried to go back, because again, live birth is seen as a big dirty joke in the New World Society. And so she has John. She also continues to behave the way that she's been conditioned to behave and makes a very bad name for herself with the locals because she sleeps with everyone, and the local women come in and, you know, threaten her life and beat her, and they're very upset.
Yeah, more culture clash happening here. But you know what they do have is a book. They've got the collected works of Shakespeare, right, which has essentially been lost or at least banned out in the big wide world, but there's a copy that's available, and John learns to read, and he apparently memorizes all of Shakespeare because we spend the rest of the book listening to him quote Shakespeare,
right,
including the title of the book, right, Brave New World, which is from a passage from The Tempest.
It's a beautiful conceit, but it's a sort of thing that doesn't really stand up if you really try to imagine somebody with no context reading Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I mean, similarly, in Fahrenheit 451, there's a passage in which the main character reads aloud a poem, I think it was by Matthew Arnold, to the assembled people, and they all have this strong emotional reaction to it. And I was thinking to myself, that would never happen in a million years, because if you had no context for this,
right,
you it would just be like listening to another language. And similarly, John has no context for the characters he's reading, but somehow it all seeps in.
This is why it's more about ideas than about kind of logic or building an entirely consistent world, because really what we're seeing here is John is representing lost society, right? He represents the world that was lost, our world. He knows Shakespeare. That is that's codified like culture, right? This is culture. It's been lost. It's art. It's one of the beautiful things about being a human being in our society. And this new society doesn't value it and has suppressed it and made it go away. And it's the only this person we call a savage who has these traits and beliefs that represent us. And so it's like a token of, and it's a theme because he gets to quote all the best Shakespeare parts at the right times and provide irony and perspective. But it doesn't really make sense other than as that symbol of our current culture that has been lost.
Right. Now, if John represents an alternative to the New World Order, part of what he represents is a life of aesthetics, which the New World doesn't have, and also a life full of passion and strong emotion. But one of the things that I think is particularly interesting about this book that I picked up really strongly this time is I don't think that John's, his worldview is any more tenable to Huxley than the New World. I mean, he's so violent, he's so selfish and prone to mood swings. I just, and this world he comes from, I think Huxley does want us to be shocked by the savagery of this world. So Huxley is setting up a dichotomy here that is kind of a false dichotomy, and I'm not exactly sure what to do with it as a reader. I wish that I had a sense that he was positing a third way out or something like that, or saying to the reader, here, you know, what, where do you draw the line or not? But it feels, as the book goes on, like, no, these are the two choices we're given.
Yeah, I not to bring Star Trek into this, because that's totally random, but there's a speech I remember from the original Star Trek where, again, in a similar vein, right, probably inspired by Brave New World, you know, the Enterprise goes to some planet that's all perfect and everybody walks around, and Captain Kirk gives one of those speeches about how, you know, you need, in order for people to be successful, they need to explore, they need to be angry, they need to be, you know, we need to have all these other things, otherwise you just have this completely antiseptic world, and we need to strive and all that. And, you know, he gives his Captain Kirk speech. But I was struck by that as I think that's sort of what is happening here, is like, not that he's saying, hey, everybody should be like the savage, but he's saying these are all the things you've engineered out of this society, and your society is the lesser for it. But you're right, it is a little bit weird, because it's not like that he comes back and becomes a well-spoken argument for going back to a more open society, right? He doesn't do that. Right. He just sort of represents kind of a counterweight to the society.
Well,
that
he's sort of an unfettered id. By the way, was that episode The Apple?
It's the one with the
bronze, tanned, blonde people wandering around, and
it's a little bit of that. And there's also the one that the names are escaping me now. There's also the one where they do the war that is done entirely on the computers.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Star Trek had like at least 5 episodes where there was kind of a semi-perfect society that Captain Kirk thought was stupid, so he ruined it.
the thing I love about the Apple is it has my favorite line from the old Star Trek series, where the ostensible savages of that planet have been told by the god that they worship to kill the crew of the Enterprise, and he says, "Vol has shown us something to do. It is a thing to do, like gathering fruit." And he holds up a melon and he smashes it.
Smashes the melon, yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, that is a delightfully bad and weird episode of Chekhov makes out with one of the natives in that episode, too.
Okay.
It's a combination of the apple and like one of those episodes where there's the one with the body of Landru, and there's the one with the people who are in the perfect society that doesn't even fire missiles in war. They just send people to the disintegration chambers, right. And he breaks their computer and says, "You gotta." But I feel like I got that vibe a little bit from The Savage, is what I'm saying. Is it's like, you need dirtiness and violence in your culture.
Right.
You need to be. And I don't think he's saying judge both sides here. I think you're right. I don't think he's doing that. Maybe it's hard to say, it was 85 years ago, but it doesn't feel that way to me. It feels like we're kind of supposed to be on his side, and I'm not sure I can get there.
Right. Now, John convinces Bernard to take him back and to take Linda back. Bernard has the ulterior motive that he knows that if he presents Linda, it will shame his boss, the director.
Yeah. Which it does.
Which it does. And then
he loses his job and is sent away to an island,
right,
presumably.
Right. The director just disappears out of the story. And Bernard, and once John comes to this new world, he's kind of the toast of the town. Everybody wants to see him. Everyone is fascinated by this savage and wants to know about what life is like outside of the world government. And Bernard uses it to his advantage to become extremely popular and to sleep around, and he pretty much forgets all of his desires for Lenina because he's living it high on this newfound popularity. But that's okay because Lenina, from this point on, only has eyes for John.
Yeah. She crushes hard on him, and yeah, Bernard is whisked away because he's no longer required. Not to tip my hand here, but I never really bought the relationship between Lenina and John. It felt like they needed to do this, so they're like, suddenly she becomes obsessed with him, right, and he falls madly in love with her.
Right.
And
there was a scene, that one of the earliest scenes between the two of them, where this burgeoning whatever kind of relationship they have happened was Lenina is in a Soma dream, and John is alone in the room with her and sees her and is immediately overcome with sexual attraction to her, but he refuses to touch her because he's too noble for that. And all I can think was like, oh, great, give him a good pat on the back because he didn't rape a woman while she was unconscious. Are we really supposed to hold this up as the paragon of virtue in this book?
Yeah.
So anyway.
Oh, we should mention that they bring Linda back from the reservation too, and this is what happens. She immediately takes Soma all the time and is going to stay in a Soma coma until she dies. Like, that is her response to coming back to society, is she just wants to be on Soma and take as much of it as she can until she dies.
Right. I think that speaks a lot to Huxley's, the way that he deals with characters is they're useful as long as he can set them up for the conversations he wants to have. And as soon as they aren't useful to those conversations, he just kind of finds a way to push them off the page. There is a sort of a burgeoning romance between Lenina and John, which is marked by the fact that Lenina is very frustrated sexually with John, doesn't know why John won't just sleep with her already. And they go to a movie, which is this movie is called A Feelie. And this section, yeah, this section is actually one of the creepiest and best sections of the book for me, because it really did feel like, oh my God, this is awful in every way. And
you're like feeling what the other people are feeling.
Right.
Yeah.
And part of the thing that makes it so creepy is this is supposed to be a lurid, salacious film about a beta guy who happens to be black, who has an accident, so he loses all self-control and goes and kidnaps an alpha woman who is white, and it's Huxley making a sudden comment on race and class and the weird eroticization of the idea of savagery and of of miscegenation. And you think, oh my God, Huxley could have gone so much darker with this book than he did.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, I don't know how much of that is our perspective from a modern time, but I did have a few of those moments of I don't know, it's 1931, right? A lot of the names of the characters in this book are like Marx and Trotsky. I think, you know, his biggest concern is the rise of communism and the idea of a loss of individualism and the threat of totalitarianism and also him seeing industrialization and the use of industrialization by the Soviets as you extrapolate from there. And so he's concerned more with stuff like that. And the fact that the Soviet Union was an atheist society too. I think he's concerned with all of that stuff a lot more than he is with maybe some of the other things that from our perspective would be like, well, you know, look at all these other things about your society that you could have critiqued. He's not up for that.
But the other thing that's really interesting to me about this dystopia is it is such a fluffy, comfortable dystopia. Everyone here is happy. There is, unlike 1984 or even Fahrenheit 451, there is no particular threat hovering over the citizenry's head. They are all very happy.
What happens? So what happens, Wolf
Helmholtz.
Helmholtz Watson.
Yeah.
Helmholtz Watson, right. He gets found out, right? He gets found out as being basically a subversive element who reads and is an individualist and all of these things. In 1984, that guy would be tortured and disappeared, right? In Brave New World, what happens? He is sent to an island of his choice. On the islands, people live as individuals in the old style. And he chooses his island. He says, I'd like to go to the Falkland Islands because the weather there is really bad. I can just stay inside and write all day, and it'll be awesome. And the director's response, or Mustafa Mann's response, is, sounds great. We'll send you right over there. So, I mean, it is like I think that's his point, right? Is like, we're all very comfortable. Nobody is rebelling, really, because it's been engineered. It's like the perfect society, and we're supposed to look upon it with horror, but it's not like there are real... The most rebellion you get is like the woman who wants to date one guy more than other guys. Wow.
There's a sequence also where... Well, first of all, there's a kind of a another ooky sequence where Lenina, once John confesses his love to Lenina, Lenina basically strips off all her clothes and thinks, oh boy, now we're finally gonna do it. And John slaps her and basically traps her in the bathroom while he rages on and on with lines from King Lear. And again, this is a part where you're like, really, are we really going to go here, where basically John is going to talk on and on about how corrupting women are and how awful it is to be sexually attracted to women, and so women need to be more modest or whatever. But right after that, John's mother is dying. Finally, Linda is dying, and John doesn't take it well and leaves the hospital and basically has like a big fist fight over a Soma distribution line, and Helmholtz comes up and starts punching out people with him, and Bernard is there doing nothing. And then what happens is the security shows up and says, are you going to come, or do we have to anesthetize you? And they're holding up like water pistols. And so that's as threatening as this world gets.
Yeah, there's that. Yeah, the riot where he throws some of the Soma that's supposed to go to the workers out the window because he's trying to do a workers' revolt. But it never really goes into anything particularly horrible. They're just going to knock him out and give him more Soma. I like the scene where it's the near riot, because I feel like that is again Huxley saying you can't even have a workers' revolution in this society. Like it's completely impossible.
Right.
It's all locked down. Everybody's fine. And I think that's an interesting argument, right? Of like, if everybody is happy at the level that they're in, and there's no discomfort, is that not a perfect society? And you have to say, well, shouldn't people be, you know, free to aspire to do different things? And the argument is they've engineered aspiration out. Like, these people don't aspire. And so you can't ever say, well, what if somebody who is a gamma wanted to be a beta? Because a gamma would never want to be a beta. They're engineered to be a gamma. It's an interesting argument, right, of like the perfection of humanity in this way. And I thought a lot about putting... I don't think this was his intent, but I spent a lot of time thinking about this from the perspective of 2016 and thinking, what if the Brave New World is challenging me, like challenging my precepts about like, why do you think individualism is important? What is the goal of life? How should society be structured? And I'm not saying I think we should make a Brave New World, because I don't, but I liked that idea, which I think I'm just supposed to recoil in horror at. But instead I was like, you know what? It's an interesting world that he's built here. Why does some of it repel me?
Right. This leads us to sort of the set piece at the end of the novel, where Bernard and Helmholtz and John especially are brought before Mustafa Mond, and Mond enjoys, you know, doing the supervillain thing of explaining everything at length about this the structure of this world. And this is where the novel's ideas are all kind of laid out very plainly. And everything we've talked about, a lot of it comes out here, where Mond is challenging John to say, you know, John is like, well, why don't, if you really care about people, why don't you automate things more? And Mond said, we tried it. We tried, you know, giving people 3-hour workdays, and they found that that didn't make them happy. You know, it's this sort of the idea that everything actually was perfectly engineered towards the highest level of human contentment. Now, you know, if it were, if John had more of a philosophical background and more like he, you might argue about what is the definition of happiness we're using here. You know, it seems more like what we're talking about is comfort in a way, or pleasure is being maximized. Right. But it turns out, you know, Mond says that, you know, everything that this society is, it isn't like Big Brother, in which some distant ruling caste has reasons of its own for clamping down on everyone's liberties, or even Fahrenheit 451, where the concern is that too much free thought will create unrest. It's more like, no, we've figured this all out. This is where it works. You know, we've done the double blind tests on everything.
Yeah, and it's this is my least favorite part of the book, by the way, is that there's a so, you know, up to the point where Mustafa Mond goes on and quotes like pages from the Bible, and it just goes on forever. Before that point, when it becomes like a book report, I actually really liked this book a lot. I was surprised at how much I liked it and how modern it felt at a lot of points, like I said at the beginning. This point, though, it's like he's now, all right, you got your dessert, but now you need to actually eat your dinner. I know that's backward, but that's what happens here. You got to eat your vegetables. Here's my entire philosophical treatise about what this is. That all said, I also have to come back to Captain Kirk and say, I feel like, you know, this is the point, is everybody's happy, but there's nothing. Like, all they're doing is existing. And it's hard to see that you'd ever actually get a society that would reach this point, because, you know, just because of the way we all work, and the way evolution works, and the way societies change and grow and evolve over time, it's hard to imagine you'd get here. But at the same time, I look at this and say, well, you know, if everybody can be fed and everybody has access to a holodeck and, you know, whatever else, is this the reason that we don't see aliens anywhere in the universe? Is it eventually we all become so technologically superior that we can make everybody happy in their own little worlds, and there's no longer any need to do anything more? And, you know, I think that's interesting. It does. Some of the appeals at the end of the book, like the long quotes from the Bible, I feel like, again, are meant to make me judge this society in ways that I am not willing to judge it. That you know, there are things about like rights that come from God and all of these things that I get the argument there, but I'm not going to make those judgments. But it's my least favorite part of the book, because it's no longer a book at that point. Now it becomes much more of a treatise.
Right. At the
and then the ending also, I would say I don't like the ending at all.
Yeah, well, the ending, I just felt like Huxley didn't quite know what he wanted to do with it, with the book, and so he came up with an ending. The one thing I will say about the Mond section is, again, I feel like we're being presented with a false dichotomy, because at the very final moments of the discussion, John is trying to say that Mustafa Mond has made the point that unless one has conflict or discomfort in your life, you can't actually produce art or culture, because those things arise out of striving. And John claims that this is what it means to be human. That's what he wants. And Mond says, if you want that, then you want a world full of war, and a world full of disease, and a world. And I feel like, no, I don't. No, that's not. those aren't the only two choices you have.
Violent passion surrogate. regularly, once a month. We flood the whole system with adrenaline. It's the complete physiological equivalent of fear and rage. All the tonic effects of murdering Desdemona and being murdered by Othello, without any of the inconvenience. But I like the inconveniences. We don't, said the controller. We prefer to do things comfortably. But I don't want comfort. I want God. I want poetry. I want real danger. I want freedom. I want goodness. I want sin. In fact, said Mustafa Mon, you're claiming the right to be unhappy. Not to mention the right to grow old and ugly and impotent, the right to have syphilis and cancer, the right to have too little to eat, the right to be lousy, the right to live in constant apprehension of what may happen tomorrow, the right to catch typhoid, the right to be tortured by unspeakable pains of every kind. There was a long silence. I claim them all, said the savage at last. Mustafa Mon shrugged his shoulders. You're welcome, he said.
Yeah. But I mean, again, I sometimes feel like I'm missing something because I am not in 1931. And that my perspective on the two choices here is, I mean, seriously, one of the reasons I was delighted by this book is I felt like I was a visitor from the future reading this book, because I am from 85 years in the future of this book. And my, all of the things that I feel like the book wanted me to feel and how it wanted me to react, I was like, yeah, I'm not going to react that way. And it was really kind of wonderful in a way, not intended by the author, but kind of wonderful that I could not get in what I felt like was the perspective he wanted me to have. And that I was way too sympathetic to the other side. Not, I felt like I was the middle ground, right? And this is sort of what you're saying, is that I look at these two things and I can't pick either of them, but I feel like I'm definitely not reviling one to the level that the book wants me to. And it's fascinating to do that. That's why I really enjoyed revisiting this, is because it made me question sort of like how our society has changed even in my lifetime, and where it's going, and what the old judgments are, and looking back on the old judgments of what absolutely was the right thing to do, and say, yeah, you know, I agree with some of them and I don't agree with some of them. That was a lot of fun to do, and that this book did do that. It was very thought-provoking, which I gotta say, 85 years later, you know, big applause for engendering that much introspection and appreciation in a book that is about society and could easily, so easily have been completely out of date by now. And I think,
well,
is not.
That was a really high note, and normally it would end on that, but we do have to touch on the the end.
Yeah, the end
scene. So Bernard and Helmholtz do get exiled off to their various places, islands. You know, it's very sad that they have to go off and live the life that they want to live.
Yeah, they can write and marry people and maybe even have kids. Who knows what they do on those crazy islands.
But John,
But not John. But not John. Why? I don't know why. He gets to go like out into the countryside in England.
He takes up in a lighthouse. And
yeah.
At this point in the book, you know, I looked back. I did one of those things where I was reading the book, and I felt like I'd missed something, some plot point that explained where we had gotten to at this point. And I kind of went back and tried to reread the opening of this chapter a few times. There is no real explanation for why he gets to live in a lighthouse.
And why people discover him and he gets hounded by the press and is not moved somewhere else, or, you know, because they do. They notice him. They realize the savage is there. They come and find him. It becomes this sort of like media sensation, or at least a lot of onlookers come to watch him. And it seems bizarre that if the point was, I mean, I'm unclear about why he went there, why they sent him there, why they didn't react when he started drawing crowds.
You know, when I got to that point and I started to really kind of wonder about the motivation or just what made it possible for this to happen, I realized that there were several points in this book where things kind of hand-waved from sequence to sequence, where people were suddenly a different place than they were before, and you kind of you kind of buy that they have perfect movement or perfect, I don't know. I don't know why anyone does anything at the end of this book, but John does take up the lighthouse where he takes up a routine of self-flagellation, which really excites all the locals who find him. They're all really keen to watch him whip himself. You know, it's kind of, I guess the society is all a bunch of like Cenobites in training, that they're all looking for the next sensation, and John is gonna.
Yeah, they can make a feely of it.
So they're really super excited to see John whip himself. They try to get him to whip himself, and then Lenina shows up, and John loses he loses his mind,
yes.
And he wants to strike Lenina, and the audience goes wild, and they start singing Orgy Porgy, which is a song that
we didn't mention the sort of like the meeting where people get in a circle and have group sex, but that happens at one point, and they do sing Orgy Porgy.
You know, this book has an enormous amount of sex in it, but it's all that kind of like yada 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 sex that like nothing is explicit. We should mention this when we talk about this as a book for high schoolers. I think that it seems highly salacious when you're a kid, but it seems enormously tame for a book in which so many people are having sex with so many other people.
Yeah, there's no details. They talk about sex, but it's not like there are ever any like real sex scenes. Even the orgy is not particularly detailed. Which is not to say that it isn't written in a somewhat lascivious way. The constant referral of women as pneumatic is there, right? I mean, it's definitely all there, where people are judging women, especially for their looks. But yeah, there's never any bits that the censor would be like, well, this is outrageous, and would rip the page out, because he's not into that.
That's a funny thing, though, that you mentioned there, the use of the word pneumatic, because he just makes that up, and he doesn't really explain it, and so it's left to, you know, there's lots of interpretations of people have about that, you know, if from its roots it could mean spirited, but it could also mean round, you know, inflated, and it's always kind of used to refer to things sexually, but it's also used in the book to refer to actual pneumatic devices.
Yeah, my read on it was that it just means that she's really good at sex. She bends in all the right ways and is inflated in all the right places, and you should check her out.
I guess the point there is also that the women themselves like to take that phrase on for themselves. That in this world where everyone is encouraged to see each other as objects, that's the greatest compliment you can pay to someone, is that you're an object. So there's a huge orgy outside the lighthouse.
John apparently takes
part in it, and wakes up super ashamed of having done this, and promptly hangs himself.
I think does he get drugged too? I think that's part of it, is that he gets swept up in it, but I think he also kind of gets drugged along with the other people in it, and so he participates in the orgy, and he's already flagellating himself for his feelings for Lenina, right? So after that, he can't take it anymore.
He hangs himself.
The end
of the book is this like reveal of the corpse, and it's another one of these kinds of EC horror comics things where we're supposed to like say, good Lord, joke. When they discover his body hanging from the lighthouse, because it's slowly rotating with the lighthouse light. Yeah.
With the boots or his feet or whatever it is. It's like his legs are turning and you're like, ah. Yeah. I can think of like 10 things I would have rather had the ending be, right? I would have rather had John and Lenina go back to the reservation. I would have had John adapt to society, or be put in a role of leadership, or sent to an island, or have them separate and have him go back, realize that this world is not for him. Lots of things that I think might have been an interesting capper, but orgy followed by hanging was just like, really? When your main character hangs himself in the very last page of the book, I gotta say that's like that's the writer just giving up. Like, I can't, I'm done here. I'm just gonna kill the character and we're done.
I feel as though Huxley had basically run out of steam. He'd said all the ideas he wanted to say, and these characters weren't really characters at this point, so he might as well have John kill himself off for shock value. But at this point in the book, nothing is shocking. You know, it's he's used up his shock value at this point.
Yeah. I just feel like he could have made his final, and we've danced around it, and I've tried to explain it as it being 85 years later, but perhaps one of the flaws of this book is that it's really unclear what the author wants us to ultimately judge. He wants to, like, set it all out there and have think about it, everybody. But I feel like he could have made a final point here at the end of, like, here's the point. John can't live in this world, or John will be broken by this world, or Lenina will realize that this world is bad and go back to the reservation with John. Or John will go to an island, and it turns out at the island the old culture still lives, and isn't that interesting? But instead it's just like, nah, I'm done. I hope you really didn't care what happened to these characters, or he doesn't tie it up. And maybe that's intentional, but yeah, it doesn't feel like as intentional as that he's just run out of steam, like you said, and needs to be done.
Now, as a high school book, I like I said, I didn't actually read this for class, but I was talking about this with my wife, and she was saying that in high school, this was a favorite of all the kids because it had so much sex in it. But it's funny to say that, because, again, that's talking about sex from that side of virginity, when you're kind of wondering about sex, you're wondering about a world about sex. Here comes this book that is ostensibly full of sex, but it doesn't really have any real erotic content to it, and it doesn't really say anything interesting about human sexuality.
No, this society is very high school, though, right? I mean, it's a whole bunch of pretty men and women concerned with dating and who's sleeping with who, and you should sleep with him, and you should go to this thing, and it's got parties and drugs and sex and all those things, right? So you could, as a student, you could read it and be like, oh wow, you know, this is cool. But you're right, as an adult, you read it and it's like, yeah, but there's not really any detail. Like, kids, I know you think that this has got all the good stuff in it, but really it's only like talking about the good stuff.
But I also mentioned this to a few people on the Facebook group, that this and a lot of them pointed to it as a favorite book in high school. I'm interested in that, and I welcome people writing in about their experience with this book, because my experience trying to read it was not good. But I read it I think way too young, and now now reading it, I enjoyed reading it. I'm curious about Huxley. He's a character that I've known about for a while, and I'm really interested in the other ways in which he's intersected with culture. I mean, in his day, he was known primarily as an essayist, and that's actually true of George Orwell. Although today we don't read many of his essays, or you only read that if you're an English major taking a class on mid 20th century British literature. But I would like to go back and read The Doors of Perception and maybe look up the Island. Right.
The Island. Yeah. Yeah. I think the thing that always struck me in school, and again, you know, being in school in the 80s, this happened. It's 1984. Everybody was talking about it. And I always see 1984 and Brave New World as juxtaposed with each other. And what's funny is they're really different. And as a kid, 1984 actually stuck with me a lot more. And maybe that was the Cold War or something like that. But totalitarianism as a concept of, like, this is what an oppressive society looks like. And you know what? We had oppressive societies then. We had them in 1948. We had them in 1984. Brave New World is about, like, it's a little bit more extrapolation of, like, where a culture could go and fall apart. And so they're different kinds of dystopias. As a high school student, Brave New World absolutely did not stick with me. As an adult, I really appreciated it at a level that I never did. So I'm not sure it really worked for me either. The fact that I assume I finished it, the fact that I don't even remember much beyond the reservation, and I really don't remember anything clearly beyond the first few chapters. Makes me wonder. Certainly, I wasn't locked in on it or anything. But I do think it's interesting if you look at the you know, Orwell, I think, is always relevant because totalitarian societies happen. Big, you know, governments want to often take over the control of information in the media. There are always totalitarian societies in places here and there. They just had the Party Congress in North Korea, right? I mean, that happens. You do have to say that the idea, and I know, Neil Postman wrote about this in Amusing Ourselves to Death. It's right up his alley, right? We don't have censorship because nobody wants to read. And is that the true horror? Is a society where everybody is so comfortable that people don't need to be compliant? They're basically, there's nothing to comply with. Everything is just completely controlled and lined up. And is that not, just by building the ultimate pleasure society, we end our inquisitiveness and all the things that Captain Kirk, at least, would argue make us human?
Well, we can't go wrong ending with Captain Kirk. Thanks again to co-host Jason Snell. Jason can be heard most regularly on the Incomparable podcast at incomparable.com, where you can also find Sophomore Lit and many other smart, funny podcasts. Thanks to my brother Dan for reading the excerpt. He has a little podcast called The Flophouse, which is available on MaximumFun.org. Do you like Beverly Clary? Then why not check out Click It Cast, a new podcast from Phil Gonzalez and me. Our first episode, Henry Huggins, is already on the streets. Get your summer reading lists on the Sophomore Lit Facebook page. Email me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. And remember, everything will be on the final.